Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, we'll learn more about the religion of Islam, about what this major world religion means in the lives of its adherents. We'll also talk about stereotypes held about Islam and Muslims, and we'll discuss issues affecting the Central Ohio Muslim community. Joining me in our studios, Muslim community leaders in Central Ohio. Imam Mohammadini is an Islamic leader who's previously served as the Imam of An-Nur Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia. He's a board member of the United Nations Association of the United States, the Columbus chapter, and a member of Merrick Coleman's Religious Advisory Council. He now lives and works and studies in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome back, Imam Mohammadini. Good to have you here.
Thank you, sir.
Leah Mohiuddin is the director of Sunrise Academy. It's a full-time Islamic school in Hilliard, Ohio. She's served in this position for the past 11 years, originally from Kentucky, a convert to Islam. Her husband is originally from India, and their son and daughter currently attend The Ohio State University. Welcome, Leah. Good to have you here.
Good morning. Thank you, Brad.
Mariam Abukar is a junior at The Ohio State University, an honors student. She was recently vice president of the Muslim Students Association of The Ohio State University, currently president of the OSU branch of CARE Ohio. That's the Council on American Islamic Relations. She is of Palestinian Lebanese descent, born and raised in Columbus. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Fred.
Dr. Asma Mubinuddin is president of the State Board of the Council on American Islamic Relations Ohio chapter, pediatrician, children's author. Her most recent book, A Party in Ramadan. Good to have you back.
Thanks, Fred.
We're at 614-292-8513 for your questions and comments. You can email questions and comments to openline at wosu.org. Well, let me ask all of you, if there were one thing you could choose that you would like our listeners to know about your faith, about Islam, I know there are many things, but if there were one thing you could choose, what would that be? What would you like to tell them, and who would like to speak first? Asma.
Thanks, Fred. Yeah, one thing that I think the general public really seems unaware of sometimes is the link between Islam and Judaism and Christianity, that when Muhammad, who Muslims consider as the last prophet, peace be upon him, when he started preaching about Islam in Mecca in the 7th century, he never understood it as his mission to start a new religion or to found something new. He always considered it his religion and his mission to get the pagan, idolatrous Arabs of his time back to the worship of the one God. The God of the Christians, the God of the Jews, the God of Abraham, God of Moses, Noah, the whole line of prophets back there. So I think that sometimes people don't appreciate that background, mm-hmm. and that Muslims worship the God of Abraham, the God of Moses, the God of Noah, the God of Ishmael and Isaac and Jacob and Job and Lot and David and Solomon. And all these people are mentioned in the Quran by name as previous prophets of God, and that the Arabic word for God, Allah, is basically just this, you know, the word for God, mm-hmm. Like Elohim in the Bible, Eloh, Allah, Semitic languages. Jesus himself likely spoke Aramaic. Alaha is the Aramaic word for God. So Jesus very likely used that term to talk to God. So I think that's one of the basic things even that I would like for people to reflect on and to know about Islam is that link and that shared history with Judaism and Christianity.
All right. Mariam Abukar, what would you like people to know?
I would like people to understand that Muslims are waiting for you to ask questions so that we are open. I want people to, listeners out there to understand that we're open to having questions. We're open to answer your questions, that we are here for other people, and that I hope that that today will encourage others to get out there. And if you see a Muslim woman who is wearing a scarf, or you see a man who seems to be Muslim, to be polite and ask. And I'm sure that we will be grateful to know that people are interested to find the truth.
That wouldn't be an affront. I mean, for me to walk up to somebody who I do not know at all, a woman wearing a headscarf, and say, "Hey, look, can you tell me something about your religion?"
Well, that is slightly awkward, but it's something that I would encourage, and that is why I say this on air, and I understand that it is something great to ask of people. But if I were walking on campus, I've had people ask me about Islam, mm-hmm. and I don't try to shy away. I truly appreciate it, and I feel that these people are interested, and it shows that it shows that they are taking that extra effort to figure out the truth. So I understand it could be a little awkward, but it can start with a little bit of dialogue. Let's say you're not comfortable to come up to somebody, maybe attend an interfaith panel or something of the sort. I know Ohio State University is having an Islamic Awareness Week later on in the month, and I'll talk about this later. But to attend certain events of that sort and to get out there and to encourage dialogue.
All right. Imam Mohammadini, what would you like people to know?
Well, I think there are a host of things that I can talk about, but if there was one that I had to pick, it would be the sense of social and collective responsibility that Islam promotes at a time when much of the world was in chaos and killing was a common thing that was happening left and right. There was a welfare system that was put together by the first Islamic leaders right after the death of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. It's amazing to see that a lot of countries in the East and West both had taken that concept, and the welfare system is just doing so well. So this is something that I would encourage folks to do a research on and look at and see how Muslims took care of not just themselves but the people that they lived with, the people that were their neighbors and so forth.
How does that work today in the Muslim community in the United States?
Well, there is still that sense of collective responsibility. The masjids, the mosques, are places where the poor are taken care of, places where marriage and death and birth and just about everything that happens in a community is taken care of. Obviously, it's not an Islamic – this is not an Islamic government, so you don't have an Islamic president, this and that. But the little things that were done before are still done just on a smaller scale.
So if a member of the local Muslim community were to present themselves at a mosque and say, look, I'm in deep trouble, I lost my job, I have no source of income, immediately can you help? Help would be forthcoming.
Yes, sir. That's mm-hmm. something that happens on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm. Leah Mohiuddin, what's the one thing you'd like everyone to know?
I think the number one thing is that Islam is a peaceful religion. I deal mainly with preschool through eighth grade kids and at Sunrise Academy. And we take the kids to various locations that where they associate with different ethnic backgrounds, different religions, different races, so forth and so on, in the other school systems. And I am surprised at how many of those students are asking my students about Islam because they don't know. They only understand what they see on TV or hear from their parents. I'll never forget going into Kroger's one time, and this one little girl, she had to be about 7 years old, and she turned around to me, and she goes, "Why are you wearing that thing on your head?" And the mother was so apologetic. And I said, "No, please, just ask questions. That's the only way we're going to understand each other." And after I explained it to the little girl and talked to the mother, she said, "You know, I'm so glad we met you today." Mm-hmm. So just ask questions and understand that it is a peaceful religion.
Leah, you are a convert to Islam, right?
Yes, I am.
American convert. What led you to – from what religion did you convert and what led you to convert?
Well, I was I'm born and raised in the good old land of Kentucky, and I was raised Southern Baptist. And I had a lot of questions as I was being raised, and as I asked these questions at the church as well as with my parents, it was always have faith. You know, they never explained the questions. And then I met my husband at the University of Kentucky, and we started to talk about Islam. And after he answered some of my questions and he gave me a book to read, Understanding Islam, I thought, you know what, there's really something here. This is the answer to all my questions. And after I converted, I realized, you know, my life is complete. Mm-hmm. So,
what was it especially when you said that Islam answers all your questions? Is there something in particular that you said, oh, this really answers this very vital question for me?
You know, I get asked that question a lot. And I think specifically it's where Jesus is concerned. Because a Southern Baptist, you know, they believe wholeheartedly something totally different than what Muslims believe. And that's mainly around the Prophet Jesus as far as what made my decision in converting Islam. Hmm.
Muslims believe that Jesus was a great prophet and a line of prophets.
That's correct.
That's right. But that the final revelation of God was given to Muhammad, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Asma.
Well, Fred, I just wanted to maybe expand on that a little bit because I think sometimes people don't understand the connection of how Jesus is so important in Islam. And Jesus is loved and respected and revered in Islam, as you mentioned, as one of the five greatest prophets of God. But Muslims don't believe that he was divine or God himself. But Muslims believe in the virgin birth to Mary. The Quran calls Jesus the Messiah, Masiha in Arabic and Hebrew. The Quran calls Jesus the Word of God, like Logos in Greek. It says he was strengthened with the Holy Spirit. Spirit. Muslims believe in the miracles that Jesus did, like raising the blind and curing, raising the dead, curing the blind, healing the sick. And Muslims believe that Jesus will come back to the earth at the end of time and that people who are believers will follow him. Mm-hmm. So there's some very interesting similarities as well as some basic differences in the understanding of the nature of Jesus. But a lot of people don't understand that to love and respect and revere Jesus is a tenet of our faith, as it is to love and respect and revere all the people we consider the prophets.
So Asma, let me ask you, you say Muslims believe that Jesus will come back to the earth at the end of time and that followers of Christianity will follow him? Is that the end?
No, that people who are believers. So
believers.
That he, as the prophet that will herald the end of time, will come back to the earth, mm-hmm. and that this will signal that the end of the world is about to come, and that there will be, you know, times of war, times of peace, but that people who are believers will realize and accept and follow Jesus coming back to remind them of the path to God, and that will herald the end of time. And then when the world is, you know, completed, there will be a day of judgment, and you know, people will be judged on mm-hmm. how they used the gifts that God gave them in his service and how they believed and things like that.
How do Muslims then figure into the end of time and the return of Jesus? How does that work?
Well, Muslims will be the first in line, I think, that we look forward to, not look forward to, but meaning that when Jesus comes back, as we believe him to be a prophet, we know from our teachings that heralds the end of this, you know, this testing time, this phase of earthly life, and we will follow him.
Will Muhammad return?
I think that we sometimes maybe have a little bit different understanding between the Christian community and some of the details of the second coming of Jesus, but absolutely that if you know, the Muslim community knows that Jesus will come back at the end of time and we look forward to following him. Now, I think, like I said, there may be a little bit difference in understanding as to what specifically he may teach, because Muslims don't believe that he would come back as God, but that he comes back as a prophet,
as a prophet,
to lead people to God.
When you say Muslims would follow him at the end of time, what does that mean at that point?
That means that they would follow him according to their own understanding, that he is a prophet that was sent by God to teach people the right way to live and to love God above all else and to love your neighbor as yourself, but not that he would say that he himself was God. We don't believe that he was God or that he ever taught that he himself was God, and that, you know, maybe there are some misunderstandings or, you know, in those types of beliefs or things like that. So we don't accept that he was God, as I had mentioned. Mm-hmm. But no, and the Prophet Muhammad would not come back. It's Jesus who will come back at the end mm-hmm. of time.
Do each of you think of yourselves, some Christians would say that they have a personal relationship with God. They think about themselves as having such. Mariam, you're nodding your head in recognition there. And do you think of yourself as having a personal relationship with God?
Of course. I would say Islam is very personable. And that's If I could say one thing about Islam, going back to your first question, and that is that Islam is a very personable religion, and many people don't see that. And I would say that to me, faith in general, and to me specifically Islam, as I am Muslim, is a gateway to a very positive attitude. And the personable factor is that I can, with my five daily prayers as a Muslim, Muslims have to pray five times a day, mm-hmm. An obligatory prayer. And that to me is my way of, quote unquote, speaking to God or asking, having that personal time with God. And the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, had said that, you know, to his companions, that if you washed yourself or took a shower or, you know, did that five times a day, would you be dirtier or, you know, physically? And they said, of course not. I mean, we're showering five times a day. And he said, well, this is what prayer does to your sins, you know. And it's not only is it religiously, you know, obligatory and it's cleansing of your soul, but it's also, I feel, a purification and the personal factor with God. I believe that Islam, not only with the obligatory things that we have to do, but with the way that God speaks to us within the Quran, encouraging patience, encouraging forgiveness, encouraging mercy, encouraging being kind to one another. Islam teaches us to do your best and to try to achieve and succeed, but at the same time to rely on God with the results. And to me, that's very personable because it reduces the amount of stress level of focusing so much on quote-unquote results. I believe that God is always watching, and that as a Muslim we need to be aware of that, but at the same time God is most merciful and is always there for us the same way that he's always watching.
The prayers that are said by Muslims five times a day,
are they
formulaic in the sense that the words are that you know them, that they're memorized, or are they very personal prayers that you simply make up yourself? And I mean, the Christians have the Our Father, the Hail Mary, formulaic prayers. What kind of praying goes on in those five times?
Well, In Arabic, there's salah, which is the actual prayer, and then there's du'a, which is supplication. So there's both, to answer your question. The formulaic prayer is more so the salah, which many people who are non-Muslim may see Muslims, you know, bowing, having, you know, those physical attributes to the prayer. Mm-hmm. Some are memorized. Certain words within are memorized. Obviously, we have to say certain chapters within or certain verses of the Quran. But then there is there's flexibility. You can recite after the first chapter, which takes only 30 seconds, approximately. You can recite any verse within the Quran, and it could be anything that you have memorized, or anything that seems of importance to you at the time. But then there's a supplication, and that's completely personable. That is where you are praising God, and at the same time, you ask for whatever it is. I'm sure listeners out there know what I'm talking about when you feel that God is your quote-unquote best friend and that he's always there for you. And I believe possibly Imam Dini might know more about this.
No, that sounds right. But I was just going to add to the question that you had asked about the position of God. See, as Muslims, everything that we do stems out of our complete obedience to Almighty Allah. Every transaction in life is within the premises of what's pleasant to God.
And you think about that consciously.
Yes, often. Yes. And what's pleasant to God is always a great thing. I have not heard of a God that has told people to kill or rape or maim in any given book, any given time. So Islam then to us is not just a private matter, but it's also the public thing that is in between all the people. It's what guides us when we go to work. It's what guides us when we go to sleep. It's what we think of when we pray. It's what we think of when we're doing business transactions and so forth. This is a complete code of life that tells you what to do, what not to do, how to live your life from the cradle to the grave.
Mm-hmm. So in every transaction, if you're saying hello to somebody, if you're making a business transaction, social transaction, you're thinking at one time or another consciously that you want this to be pleasing to God.
And that's the great thing about it, because you don't have to be praying to be getting rewards from the Almighty Allah. Mm-hmm. You could be saying hello to somebody, and that's seen by God as a pleasant act and as an act of charity. Hello to somebody. Hey, how are you doing? Helping out somebody. Every one of these things are not just wasted. Every one of them commands a level of reward with God.
So you would, a Muslim then would have to think twice about angry words.
Yes, sir.
Or about lying or about...
Yes.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
One interesting thing about the definition or understanding of the concept of worship, as you were talking about, Fred, is that in Islam you have the ritualistic, you know, the worship, the prayer, the fasting, giving, and charity, but you also make all the space in your life sacred, because any action that's done with the intent to please God, as Imam Dini had said, is an act of worship in Islam. So if I'm saying hello to somebody for the purpose of, I know God likes people to have good relations, I want to greet them with a smiling face, I want them to feel good, that is actually literally an act of worship in Islam. So your whole private space, your whole daily space, public spheres, which could be mundane or could be profane, take on an air of being sacred when they are done with the right intention, which is that of pleasing God, and then you serve humanity through serving God.
Well, let me ask you an interesting question here. You know, many Christian writers and writers of other religions have had what they call dark nights of the soul, in which Mother Teresa was one of those who doubted the existence of God, she said, and doubted the truth of her faith. Do Muslims have dark nights of the soul as well, in which you doubt the existence of Allah or doubt the truth of your faith?
Let me start with that. The existence of God or the belief in God is the most prominent element within the Islamic faith. One cannot be a Muslim without believing the existence and the power and the attributes of God. And we think that the signs around us all over the place, the oceans and the mountains and the heavens and how high they are, and there are no pillars supporting it, and the earth and how flat it is, and the people. It's amazing that sometimes a friend of mine had told me, he said, look, when we speak, this little tongue, look, it's a very small thing. It moving up and down is what gives us this strength to speak. If I was to just touch or hold my tongue with just one finger, look, you wouldn't know what I'm saying. But just something as small as this is the work of God. Therefore, God is Islam and Islam is God. Without God, one cannot, without believing in God and the power of God and the attributes of God and the existence of God, one simply cannot be a Muslim.
I understand that would be true of Christians, and I would think as well as one example. But you know, the great Christian writers say we've doubted, we've thought perhaps God doesn't exist. We've seen the evil in the world, the terrible suffering. And personally, Mother Teresa said, I doubted his existence.
Well, God is great, but the people could be great or bad, both. We've got good people and bad people in every country at any given time, in any religion. There's a black sheep in every community.
Mm-hmm. All true, but have you ever doubted? Mariam?
I would like to say one thing, that Muslims are human as well. And that, of course, as a human being, you want to use your logic and your mind and think, well, is what I read in this Quran, is it truth? The same way that if I were reading a textbook, I would say, well, how do the scientists or how do these researchers know that this is the truth? And yes, I believe that there are times when a Muslim might go through phases where they might think, I wouldn't say doubt, but they would just question. Mm-hmm. And I would say that this is a sign of, this is a, I feel kind of reluctant to say this, but it's quote unquote a good thing because it shows that you're thinking. Mm-hmm. And the thing that brings me back to God is realizing that there are things in the Quran that were written, the Quran was brought down over 1400 years ago. And there are things in there, if we just want to talk about the scientific miracles that were written in the Quran, that were written 1400 years ago, there is no way that a man such as Prophet Muhammad could have come up with these things on his own. And these miracles that are within the Quran show that this had to have come from another being, a greater being that is non-human. And in addition to that, just to go back to your question about how when Mother Teresa doubted God because of all the evil in the world, and as a Muslim, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, had said that a Muslim can never really be upset. If they are consciously thinking about Islam and consciously thinking about their intention and everything that they do with every transaction, they can never truly be upset, because if they are afflicted with a calamity or if they're afflicted with something that is just unpleasant, it's very unfortunate, mm-hmm. In life, if they are patient and they strive through it, God will reward them, and they will know that there is a reward with God, that God never forgets and God is always there and God is all-knowing and God sees everything. And at the same time, if a Muslim is blessed with something and they thank God, God gives them more. So, as a Muslim, as a Muslim, you can never truly be upset. And so, with going back to Mother Teresa's statement, as a Muslim, when I do see the evils of the world, I don't think that it's God's fault, that there's no way that there could be a God, that the world would be perfect if there were God. No, we're here for a reason. We're being tested. And if you see a calamity, if you need to, as a fellow human being, you need to change that. And the Prophet also said, if you see something, change it with your hands, action. And if you can't, change it with your tongue and speak about it. And if you can't do that, just think that it is wrong, but that is the weakest of faith. So as Muslims, we are encouraged to change the world and to change the evils of the world, to make a positive change with the world, and to see that the evils of the world are not a reflection of who God is, but a reflection of who people are, and that there are tests in the world for a reason.
We're talking with Central Ohio Muslim community leaders. We're going to pause here. Callers, hang on the line. We'll get right to you right after these messages of WOSU 820 NPR News.
WOSU News reports on stories from around the state and in your backyard.
Starting with Columbus Mayor Michael Coleman, one solemn-faced official after another gave similar assessments about Columbus finances.
We are now in an unprecedented financial dilemma. It is crisis time.
Get more from your news with the award-winning WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM, NPR News, and classical music.
And good morning. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. I'm Amy Jurovich. On Point this afternoon, credit card reform is hot on Capitol Hill. Consumers stand to get protections, but banks say it's the wrong reform at the wrong time. On Point will hear the debate. That's on On Point here at 1 o'clock this afternoon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Taking a look at the weather forecast for today, some sunshine and some clouds in the weather forecast, a high of 73 degrees. For tonight, partly cloudy, a slight chance of evening showers, mostly clear after midnight, and a low of 55. For Wednesday, some sunshine with a chance of afternoon rain, maybe a thunderstorm on Wednesday, and a high of 74. Looking ahead to Thursday, a 50% chance of rain for Thursday and a little warmer with a high of 78. Currently 59 degrees in downtown Columbus. We now return to Open Line with Fred Anderle. Thanks for joining us this morning. It is 59 degrees at 10:30.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. We're talking with leaders of Central Ohio's Muslim community. We're talking about the faith of Islam, but also issues affecting the community and of interest and concern to the community. Once again, to reintroduce everybody, Dr. Asma Mobeen Uddin is president of the State Board of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Ohio chapter. That's CARE. She's a pediatrician, children's author. Her most recent book, children's book, came out last month. It's titled A Party in Ramadan. Mariam Abukar is a junior at The Ohio State University, an honors student. She was recently vice president of the Muslim Students Association at OSU, currently president of the OSU branch of CARE Ohio, born and raised in Columbus. She's of Palestinian-Lebanese descent. Leah Mohiuddin is the director of Sunrise Academy, a full-time Islamic school in Hilliard, originally from Kentucky, a convert to Islam. Imam Muhammad Dini, an Islamic leader, previously served as the Imam of An-Nur Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia. He's a member of Mayor Michael Coleman's Religious Advisory Council. He was born in Somalia, and Imam Dini now lives, works, and studies in Columbus. 614-292-8513. Emails to openline at wosu.org. Call us. Thank you for waiting. Ahmed is our first caller. How are you on the air?
Good morning. My question to your guest is why the Muslim community, especially in Ohio, they don't do enough to educate people who are not Muslim to teach them about Islam. I didn't see nothing. And when you watch the media in the United States in general, people blame Muslim people about the terrorism, about the suicide bomb, and the fanatic, the integrist. While the majority of Muslim people, they don't defend themselves. They don't come up on the TV, they invite to expand Islam. The majority of the people are not terrorists or integrist. The second thing is this. We from West Africa as a Muslim. I'm a Muslim, or my family are Muslim. Many Muslim people who live in the United States, especially in the state of Ohio, they have more freedom in the United States than their own original country. Why they don't thank enough the state of Ohio?
All right. So our caller is asking, how come Muslims don't step forward to talk about the Islamic experience in Ohio and the United States? He says often what we see on television is extreme radical Muslims who are terrorists.
Fred, we hear his concern, and I think each one of us feels that pain, if you will, that there's so much misunderstanding and people don't really understand our religion at all. And as part of the Muslim community, I think many of us in many different spheres, and probably every single person that you see on this panel, has devoted much of their life and their time to trying to educate their colleagues and their friends and in a general way about the community at large about Islam. Now, unfortunately, Muslims are not as established in fields such as communication, journalism, the newspapers, to be able to have, ultimate access to really, educational materials and things, but we're here. And if you search on the internet, and if you, people are trying, Muslim organizations are working, as well as they can. And certainly we are kind of a community that is learning the ropes, if you will, in terms of being more proactive and effective in communicating the message of what Islam is and what the Muslim community is. So I don't think it's for lack of effort, but I think that certainly we all need to start by knowing our colleagues and our communities, and also to have more to have the Muslim organizations that are working in the political and educational and communication arenas, to continue the work. And I think one of the biggest challenges we still face in 2009 is the anti-Muslim hostility and outright lies that we do hear about our faith by some individuals and groups. And, it's unfortunate that this misinformation is out there and that there are people who do have agendas in trying to promote this. And they prey on people's fears and lack of knowledge. And many people are susceptible. So unfortunately, we are also dealing with people who have those types of agendas in the education. But we're here, and we thank you for allowing us to be here, Fred.
Asmi, you talk about the lies told about it. Islam by people who have agendas, for example?
Probably everything that the gentleman mentioned. I mean, certain things about the basics of the faith, you know, crazy things like it's a Muslim's responsibility to kill somebody who's not their faith, person of their faith, that Muslims worship a moon god, that Allah is not, you know, the God of the Christians or the Jews, that Muslims want to take over the country and the world. And they're, you know, the purpose of the Muslim community in America is to try to establish Sharia and overthrow the Constitution. I mean, you know, we're all smiling here because it would just be lunacy if it weren't that people believe these types of things. The Muslim American community wants to live in peace and justice and cooperation and friendliness and respect and tolerance with our neighbors. We value being in America. We love our faith. We love our country. Many of the values in of America are values of our own faith, and people have come and chosen to be in America because, as the gentleman said, many people find it more – they find that they can practice their religion in America better than they can in any country that they came from, and that's absolutely true. And Muslims are dedicated to promoting the safety and the security of this country, and we also love our faith, and we need people to understand that our faith upholds all of these, you know, values of justice and compassion and goodwill to humanity and being in charge of taking care of humanity. And so we have a lot of work to do, I think, to overcome the barriers, but we are working, and we are grateful for people of conscience and goodwill who are working with us.
Asma, you're president of the State Board of the Council on American Islamic Relations, Ohio chapter. The acronym is CARE. And news reports just over recent days say the FBI has suspended much of its work with CARE after cooperating for years on the training of agents and outreach to Muslims. The CARE would work with the FBI. But Assistant FBI Director John Miller says the FBI has had to limit its formal contact with CARE offices. They're talking about a meeting in 1993 when allegedly two CARE officials participated in a meeting about how to represent Hamas in the United States. 2 years after 1993, Hamas was declared by the U.S. government a terrorist organization. And also we have a report that the Columbus Police Department, following that, is now saying we are not allowing CARE representatives to be teaching cultural diversity classes at the Columbus Police Academy anymore. So how would you respond to that?
Well, Fred, this is just another example of the types of challenges that we in the Muslim community are facing. And we think that these issues are politically motivated, that they are a legacy of the counterproductive and the misguided policies of the previous administration. And the American Muslim community has filed legal challenges to this issue. We are trying to work on it politically. We have requested a meeting with Attorney General Eric Holder to address the issues of these accusations. So there is no truth to any of the accusations that CARE is associated with Hamas or anything like that. And again, we had a previous administration in this country that targeted and did not treat the American Muslim community as an equal partner or with fairness. And I think we're still seeing the legacy of that. And like I said, as a Muslim community, we are challenging these issues. And we hope that under the Obama administration, we will have a better relationship. And certainly President Obama has tried to set the tone that there will be mutual respect and understanding between the United States and the Muslim world. And we stand poised to be part of that change.
Mm-hmm. So CARE has no interest or affiliation with Hamas?
No, absolutely not. CARE is an American Muslim organization. It was founded in this country to help people better understand Islam and Muslims and to be a voice for justice, whether it's for Muslims or for people outside the Muslim community, although we tend to do most of the work associated with justice here. Regarding the police department, it's an unfortunate effect, Fred. We have trained more than seven times at the Columbus Police Training Academy in the past 5 years, with excellent feedback and excellent results, and been, you know, very very positive comments from the uniformed officers and the recruits and people who had attended those sessions. And now with this national issues that are going on between the FBI and CARE, and from my understanding, I mean, CARE is trying to work with these issues with the FBI, but has not found a willing partner in trying to resolve these issues. Then that has filtered down to some of the local relationships, which have not had problems or things like that. So I think as soon as we resolve some of these national issues, which I am confident that we have the assurance from the police academy that if those national issues are taken care of, that we would mm-hmm. restart our recruit training.
You know, on the other hand, some Muslim groups, according to a report just yesterday from the Associated Press, some Muslim groups are upset with the FBI. They're saying that new Justice Department guidelines encourage profiling, say some Muslim groups, and they're upset about the FBI's recent suspension of ties with CARE. And so some of them say, look, they want to cooperate with the FBI still on issues of national security, no question about that, and safety issues as well. But they feel the FBI and community outreach is doing surveilling in mosques and unfairly spying upon Muslims. What's your response to that?
Well, absolutely. And you can do Google searches and find these articles. I mean, the Associated Press and news stories have been written about how in Detroit to California, the FBI has paid informants, and the people that they've chosen are convicted criminals. There's a specific person. You can look up the articles on it. They paid a convicted criminal to infiltrate or go into a mosque undercover and try to incite people to terrorism. Now, this is not treating the community with respect. I mean, if the FBI wants to know what's going on in mosques, believe me, Fred, the Muslim community is open. You can come in the front door. You're welcome in the mosques. You can visit the schools. You can visit the mosques. You're welcome. You don't need to pay criminals to come in and try to incite people and then wonder, well, is this person trustable or not? I mean, you can Google the articles and things like that. These are coercive. They're intimidating. They're illegal techniques. And can you blame the Muslim community if they're on one hand seeing the FBI publicly saying we want to reach out and build bridges, and on the other hand they're participating in, you know, these types of activities? Well, then, of course, the trust with the Muslim community gets severed, and people are just reacting that we want to be treated as equal. We want to be treated with fairness, with respect. We don't need to be more equal before the law, but we need to have the same respect, and people follow the law dealing with the Muslim community than they do with any other religious community in this country. That's American. That's the American way. That, you know, we don't and, you know, unfortunately, with civil rights groups and issues in history, the FBI has not had a stellar record, and I'm sorry about that, but, you know, we're continuing to work with law enforcement. We hope to resolve these issues, but we need to be treated with the fairness and respect that our country demands.
This is the Obama administration FBI that is doing this.
Well, I mean, I think that we still have – I mean, the policies and the procedures that have been in place since the last administration are not going to get overturned overnight. And so we – with the new vision and agenda, I think, that President Obama has brought to the nation with regards to the way we deal with Muslims in the Muslim community, I am hopeful that these types of policies will filter down and will change over some of the processes that have been set in place, but it's only been a short time, and those processes are still in place right now from the previous administration.
According to the Associated Press, these are new Justice Department guidelines that Muslim groups say encourage profiling. New guidelines. Presumably under the Obama administration.
Okay, yeah. I guess I'm not familiar exactly with maybe the dates and things, so that would be something to look into. But I think the Muslim community has hope that President Obama will bring a justice and a fairness to the situation, and that he will recognize the American Muslim community as a partner in the citizens keeping this country safe and secure, but also recognize that to be truly American, we need to live the values of our country of justice and fairness and compassion and not treating people as guilty until they are proven to be guilty. That's what we're about as Americans, and we need to uphold that, starting from the top of the office down.
Okay, back to our callers. Joe is next. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Fred. Thank you for this informative discussion. I have a comment about early Christianity at the time of the prophet. Most Christians at the time of the prophet were Nestorian Christians or Gnostic Christians. That is, Christians who believed that God imbued Jesus with the Spirit of God and that Jesus was not actually the Son of God. I also have a quote from Ramsey Clark, who was the Attorney General. In 1998, he said, "Islam is the one hope for the poor of the world to have any decencies in their life. It is the one revolutionary force that cares about humanity." This is our former Attorney General. And then I have a question for your guests, which is, at the night journey of Muhammad, which is his mystical experience when he ascended to heaven, he reports that as he ascended into heaven, he had trouble breathing. My question is, how would the prophet know this? I'll take my answers off the air. And Frank and Fred, thank you very much for your service over the years.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks very much.
Let me say a few things about what Brother Joe said.
Yeah.
First of all, it's amazing to know that there were people, Christians, who had that view of Jesus. It sounds very similar to the one that we Muslims have. The creation of Jesus by Allah is an indication of his power and might. The first person, the first human person, the prophet Adam, Muslims consider him a prophet as well, was created without a father and a mother, out of clay. And then Jesus came about with a mother and no father. And you, Fred, came about with a father and a mother. This is a pattern that shows you how powerful God is and that he's able to create anybody from anything with or without parents or with one parent for that matter. It's amazing. Once again, I really had no idea that there were people around at the time that viewed the birth of Jesus in that regard. The question about the journey of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, to the high heavens, I have not heard this story where he had a hard time breathing. I'm not quite sure where Brother Joe gets that from.
I wanted to go back to one of Joe's other remarks about Islam and the poor. Let me ask you, in Islam, what is your duty to the poor, to the unfortunate, to the dispossessed? What does Islam say about that? Leah, how about you?
Thank you. Right. It says that we need to help everyone, and specifically the ones that are in need. And we at the school, we do a lot of activities around that. We're doing food drives. We have people within our school, say, for an example, during Eid holidays, that do not have food at home. So the kids take up money. We purchase food. We constantly are giving clothes to kids at the school who just come to the school without the uniforms that are not appropriate or are not clean. So we're trying to teach that specifically. You need to take care of everybody, especially the ones who are in need. And that's the number one thing that we do try to instill in the kids at the school.
Mm-hmm. Is this very similar to the Judeo-Christian injunction to help the poor? I mean, I don't see a lot of difference there. Is this?
No.
We all have a duty, no matter what our religious tradition, those who have a tradition, to the poor, right?
Absolutely. And whatever we have, God has entrusted to us. So we don't even own, you know, in the sense that people who work and make money and stuff, they may sometimes develop a false confidence or even an arrogance that I deserve this. But we understand as Muslims that whatever we have is a gift to us that is entrusted to us by God for the purpose of our time on the earth, and that we will be judged by God on how we used his gifts in his service at the end of time. So for us to give to the poor is even just a way of showing the bounty of God that God has given to us and being grateful to God for what he has given to us and taking care of humanity, and that, the idea of charity and caring for others, this is at the very cornerstone of our faith. And the purpose, mm-hmm. I mean, even there are teachings in the Quran and there are similar teachings in the Bible that at the end of time, you know, God will say to the child of Adam, "Oh, child of Adam, I was sick and you didn't visit me." And he said, "You're the Lord of the worlds. How could I visit you?" The person on the Day of Judgment is saying this. And God says, "Well, didn't you know that my servant, this particular person, was sick and you didn't visit him? And if you had visited him, you would have found me with him. And you didn't give this person a drink and you didn't." So the same types of things that when you serve humanity, you are directly serving God. And another interesting teaching on this was that the wife of the Prophet Aisha, before she would give in charity, she would actually perfume the notes that she was giving in charity. And they asked her, you know, "Why are you doing this? Like, you know, you're giving to the poor, but you're putting perfume." And she said, "Before it goes to the hand of the poor person, this charity, my intention goes, the charity goes directly into the hand of God. And then it gets distributed from there." So that idea that to beautify what you give and to give the best of what you have is an Islamic teaching on charity too, that when you're giving charity, you shouldn't pick out the dregs of something or the bottom or the holy pants or the whatever. You give the best of what you had as a way of showing the bounty that God has given to you.
I've heard that Muslims are asked to give a certain percentage of their net worth every year to the poor and to charity. Is that right?
Yes.
What is that percentage?
2.5%
mm-hmm. of your total wealth on hand.
Of your total wealth on hand.
Right. Not your daily, not your income, but after your basic needs have been met, mm-hmm. of your total wealth on hand. So that would be extra money in the bank, stocks, bonds, livestock, gold jewelry, real estate that's not your primary residence. On all of that, the minimum that you need to give is 2.5%. But, of course, people are encouraged to give more. And there are teachings of the Prophet Muhammad that every joint of a person should give in charity. You know, every day the sun comes up. And people ask, well, how can you give that much charity? And he defined charity as not only giving in money, but smiling at somebody else, removing something harmful from the road so somebody else doesn't get hurt by it, helping somebody else onto their mount or into their carriage or something. So anything good that you do to another person with the intention of pleasing God is an act of charity, and certainly giving of your money and your time and your wealth and your efforts are all part of that.
Surely. Muhammad.
Well, nothing we possess on earth belongs to us. Everything belongs to Allah. And everything belongs to Allah, and it's meant to be served. It's meant to serve the creation of God. For instance, there is a hadith, a saying of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that says, I'll say this in Arabic and translate afterwards, "Inna Allah fi auni al-abdi ma kana al-abdu fi auni akhi." Allah is in the aid of a servant as long as that servant is in the aid of another servant. So to serve the creation of God is a way of serving God himself. And this is a very basic and fundamental principle in Islam.
You say to serve the creation of God. Does Islam talk about our requirements for the earth and for the animals upon the earth as stewards of the earth? Is there any statement made about that?
It does. As a matter of fact, there are a number of verses that speak about our responsibilities towards the mountains, towards the rivers and the streams, the lakes, the trees. There are seasons not to cut them. There are places not to go hunting and so forth. Every living creature has rights and responsibilities in Islam. The people, the trees, just about everything. So yes, there's a great deal of that in Islam.
Do you feel, as Muslims in our Central Ohio community, a small minority numerically population, do you feel comfortable here? Do you feel accepted by your neighbors? On the other hand, do you feel discrimination? I mean, what's your state of being here? Leah, how about you?
I think by being a convert, I've been asked that question a lot. You feel comfortable in who you are, number one thing, and I am comfortable being Muslim. Yes, I'll go out to places and I get the stares and I get the looks.
Because you're wearing a headscarf.
Because
right?
I'm wearing a headscarf, or because I'm with some other children, I'll have a group of Muslim children with me, the girls, and they'll have headscarves on, and we'll get the looks and so forth and so on. And the number one thing that we teach the kids is, you know, people are going to look at you and look at your actions. So what we have to do is we have to portray what we are as Muslims. We are good people. And yes, we get the stares, but then again, I hope people look at me and look at my actions. And after they get to talk to me, they'll understand that I am a pretty good person, even though, you know, I'm directed by my religion, and that's what makes me who I am.
Other than the stares, are people pretty friendly? Is the community a welcoming community?
Yes, Miriam? I feel that the community is very welcoming, but to echo what Sister Leo said, that it definitely depends on your actions and the way you view yourself. I was born in America. I was actually born here at Riverside Hospital. And though my parents are from Palestinian descent, and I did not decide to wear the scarf until I was about 14, and that was my decision solely. I surprised my parents, and the way that I identified myself with my headscarf was by being comfortable with it myself. When I knew the reasons of why I did it, the reasons of why I am Muslim and what it portrays for me, it's not the pinnacle of the religion as a Muslim female. It's just the beginning. Because it forces you to keep yourself in check as well. For you to be a minority in Columbus makes you realize that when I'm wearing the headscarf and I'm walking on campus, or if I'm going to the grocery store, or if I'm doing anything in public, I need to realize that my actions are going to be judged and looked at by others who may not know anything about Islam, and that I need to uphold my religion to the best of my abilities, and that I am no longer Maryam or Asma or Leah or Muhammad. I am Islam at this point. So
everybody knows it. You're demonstrating that with the headscarf. So you're
right. Exactly. People know when you walk into a room, you have Muslim on your forehead.
Sure.
You know, maybe it's easier for the guys, but for the girls, you can't really hide it.
And again, you wear a headscarf because?
My personal decision was when I realized, I mean, there are different opinions within the Muslim community, females, of if you should or shouldn't. But from my understanding, Islam says it is an obligation for women to be modest. And it's not just the headscarf and then wearing tight jeans. It's the whole demeanor. It's not only your dress and for it to be loose and long and to be modest, but it's your speech. It's the way you walk. It's the way you present yourself. So to me, modesty was the next step for me at that age. And when I decided to wear it, when it became me, I became comfortable with it. And that's when I realized that no matter if I get the looks, if I feel different, if I'm the only Muslim in the undergraduate student government at Ohio State, which I was, that I that I am a representative of that, and that I, since I'm comfortable with myself, then that is what people will see. When you're comfortable with yourself, people will see that comfort in that respect. Right.
Let us go to Kelly. Hello, Kelly. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Fred.
Quickly now, because we're running out of time.
Okay. Just there's a division within Christianity and Judaism for centuries about the notion of God, on the one hand, being a God of mercy and compassion, or God being a God of justice, which has led to a division in how we respond to other people, including, for example, just war theory and that sort of thing. Is there a similar division within Islam, and if so, how is that reconciled?
I don't think that Muslims have a difficulty or a division with the concepts of God being all just as well as all merciful and all compassionate and all forgiving. So there are many attributes of God that Muslims look at and understand, but we don't see a kind of clash, if you will, that God is great enough to be all of those all together at the same time. And these are of his attributes. The first attributes that God defines himself with in the Quran is the all merciful, the all forgiving, the merciful. Giving, but and he also has said that his mercy exceeds his wrath. So Muslims know that God is more merciful than he is angry, if he were to be angry. But he is the all just. But God alone knows how, in his infinite knowledge and wisdom, to have the attributes of justice and mercy exhibit themselves in the way that he deals with creation. And what we as Muslims just accept or know is that it is perfect the way that he deals. So whatever opportunities, whatever issues, whatever happens, we know that God is all just and all merciful, and we can, you know, we can trust in that. We don't see a clash or a division or a conflict with believing that God is the superlative of both of those attributes together. And we do our best to try it ourselves to be, you know, I mean, justice, but there's mercy is a part of justice. You know, justice is not just hard or rigid. There's always the opportunity for forgiveness, and Islam and the Quran encourage forgiveness, especially if there are intentions that people are sorry and things like that. So mercy, I think, would be, you know, the attribute that God has said, you know, again, mercy is greater than his wrath.
Kelly, thank you. Well, as faithful Muslims, what do you, how do you react when you hear that the Taliban is burning down girls' schools in Afghanistan, and there have been acid attacks against young girls going to school? How do you feel when you see Al-Qaeda or some other groups beheading somebody on videotape and advocating a violent jihad? What, Miriam, what's your reaction to that?
My reaction is that, not to be cliche, but my heart does hurt, because not only for the humanitarian aspect, for those that are being victimized, but also when you see misrepresentation of who you are, you have this sense of desire to change that and to speak out. It's as though you're mute, but you can't say anything, and you feel as though you want to. And you want to show the world that this is not Islam. This is a culturally this is just culture. It is not Islam. And to go back to the Muslim Student Association, specifically with the issue of Afghanistan, the students on campus with some of the Columbus community managed to raise over 2 tons of clothes for the Afghani people. And we sent this through the U.S. military, and we as Muslims see the injustice that is being done to our fellow Muslims. And we see that those who are being victimized are being victimized under the impression that this is what Islam is, but viewers and listeners need to recognize, to be critical of what they see, and to recognize that this is not Islam. And I encourage everybody to question what they see and to truly research it and find what Islam is truly about.
Mm-hmm. Would anyone else like to comment? We have just about a minute left.
Well, there are do's and don'ts in everything that you do in Islam. The beauty about Islam is that it's not something that you just do whatever you want to and then give it justified in the name of Islam. The killing of people with blades and knives and so forth is unacceptable in Islam. The blowing up of cars and suicide bombings and somebody blowing himself up and taking his own life is unacceptable in Islam. Whether that happens in Afghanistan or in Germany or in Jamaica, it's just not unacceptable, period.
All right. Before we close, Mary, you want to tell us about Islamic Awareness Week here at the Ohio State University,
yes.
And there's a website.
Yes, there's a website. Viewers, HTTP, msa.ohio-state.edu. Again, that's msa.ohio-state.edu. You can find information on that website. Islamic Awareness Week is open to students and non-students at Ohio State University. We encourage everyone, all of our listeners, to please attend on Tuesday, the 26th, Wednesday, the 28th, and Thursday, May. So it's this month. We have a workshop on women in Islam. Then we have an Islam 101, and then we have an interfaith panel on Thursday. So I would welcome everyone to attend.
All right. We want to thank you for coming. Maryam Abukar, Aliyah Mohiuddin, Asma Mohiuddin, Ima Mohammadidi. A great pleasure. Thanks for being with us on the show today.
Thank you for having us.
And when we come back, a conservationist manifesto with essayist Scott Russell Sanders on WOSU 820 NPR News, Columbus.